thousands of minors are arrested each year in Duval County. Just ahead, why diversion, not prison, for these kids is an increasing focus for youngsters who get into trouble. That conversation's just ahead. Good Monday morning. Hope you had a great holiday weekend. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show's always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And watch the show now with video on demand at our partner TVJax.com. Just ahead, we'll take your calls on juvenile diversion programs here on the First Coast. What are your questions and comments? 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Then later, First Coast Success profiles Leslie Slover of Deutsche Bank. A look at the TEDx conference coming up in Jacksonville and sports with Cole Pepper as the Final Four is set. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, when it comes to juveniles in Duval County, more than 1,000 of them are arrested each year, sometimes for serious offenses, but more often than not because they just showed bad judgment or were subject to bad influences. Increasingly, keeping these kids out of the criminal justice system is a priority for the courts, the police, and more. Over the weekend, the Florida Times-Union took a close look at these juvenile diversion programs and rated their effectiveness and the return to the taxpayer. Education reporter Tessa Duval is writing this series, and she joins us now in studio to explain. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts and questions about the increasing focus in the criminal justice world on juvenile diversion for youngsters, not the criminal justice system? What do you think about that? And what are your questions? Call us up right now, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet us or weigh in on Facebook. So there are four programs you looked at, Tessa. Can you tell us what they are?
Yes, absolutely. So you have teen court and neighborhood accountability boards, which are the primary civil citation programs in Duval County. Civil citations do not require an arrest, and so they are preferred by advocates for misdemeanors for a lot of reasons. You're skipping that whole step of putting a kid in handcuffs and taking them to detention and really just getting to their issues without getting a judge and attorneys involved. The state attorney's office also has its youthful offender program, which is for misdemeanors and felonies. It's the largest diversion program available to kids locally. Mm-hmm. And then you also have juvenile drug court, which is a small but very intensive program for kids that have serious addictions. And if not for those addictions, they wouldn't have committed their crime in the first place.
So you looked at these four programs, and what did you find in terms of how effective they are? How are they working?
Well, the good news is that the programs all have some things that advocates say we need to be doing when we're diverting kids. They all start with an assessment or a hearing of some kind to really get to the kids' issues, to find out why they're doing what they're doing. Because just because two or three children stole doesn't mean they all stole for the same reason. Mm-hmm. But from there is when you start to see some differences. The state attorney has a very intentionally tough program. You know, the director of the diversion program says, you know, these kids aren't scared of anything. I've just got to put the facts in front of them about if they continue down this road, you know, this is where they're going to end up. This is what's going to happen. But mm-hmm. you have the civil citation programs where, you know, these kids are, it's their first or maybe now second or third because the law has changed to allow multiple civil citations. But it's really one of their first brushes with the law. And so it's kind of nipping it in the bud.
If you're just tuning in as we speak with the TU's Tessa Duval, four different diversion programs in Duval County serve more than 1,000 area kids. What are your questions about these efforts? They cost a little more than $1 million a year to run. Something Tessa Duval says is a bargain for you, the taxpayers, when you compare it to the cost of locking kids up. What do you think about that? We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. And as you wrote on Jacksonville.com and in the Florida Times-Union, that $1.3 million a year is a bargain. Can you explain why?
It is. So take into consideration teen court, for example, which national estimates put the whole regimen of teen court services at about $600 per case. You know, teen court, neighborhood accountability boards, they last about 90 days. But just if a kid is arrested and taken to detention, detention costs more than $200 a day. And so you can very quickly see how once you add in things like a judge's time, probation officer's time, officer's time, I mean, it's just, it adds up very, very quickly. And so, you know, not only are we talking about saving money, we're also talking about kids' futures. And think about the impact that a criminal record can have on getting a job. And when you start to factor these things in, it really just is such a bargain for so many reasons.
That's the big push, isn't it? That the idea that if a kid is put into the system before they turn 18, that record stays with them for many years. The idea is to avoid that if possible.
Right, exactly.
Right? And why is that so important?
Well, there is some good news, actually. Previously, or the governor this session signed a bill into law that lowers the automatic age of expunction to 21, whereas previously it was 24 for some offenses. So think that if you are, you know, you're getting out of high school, but you have this record that is going to stay with you for six more years. Think about how that can put you behind your peers just right out of the gate.
So in order to have a child have a decent prospect for an education or a career, the thinking with, they're increasingly known as smart justice reformers.
Right.
The thinking is it's better to divert the child, make sure that there's no record. If it's an offense that doesn't involve serious violence to others. Is that basically it?
Right. With a civil citation, it's essentially like a ticket. You know, there's no need to put the kid in handcuffs to take them to detention. They just get this form, they sign off on it, their parent has to sign off on it. In cases with victims, the victim needs to agree to it. And then from there, it can go to teen court or the neighborhood accountability boards, where sanctions are handed out very swiftly, and the programs are very efficient. They have a very low recidivism rate, and it's actually much lower than if we arrest kids and then divert them.
Now, you mentioned civil citations. Here in our Fourth Judicial Circuit, there's been a lot of pressure on State Attorney Angela Corey by various groups and members of the Duval legislative delegation to increase the number of civil citations issued. What about that aspect of it? The state attorney has argued that the diversion programs she's running are working.
Well, it's important to understand that civil citation starts with the responding officer. And so what's encouraging to advocates is that Sheriff Mike Williams has been very open to increasing the usage of civil citations. You know, he has a police lieutenant on every neighborhood accountability board, which is one of the entities that sanctions civil citations. He's got a lot of his officers being trained. There are some new policies being put in place that groups like ICARE and others that really press for more civil citations seem very encouraged by. So it is important to know that, you know, it does not start with the state attorney's office, though it must go through the state attorney's office. And one thing that is very controversial is that Ms. Corey does not allow for battery cases to receive civil citations. They might still be diverted to her program, but they will not receive a citation because she takes that much more seriously. And while state statute does allow for batteries to receive citations, it also gives local jurisdictions control over what they allow to receive citations.
And how does the Fourth Circuit compare to other circuits around the state in terms of that difference?
So last fiscal year, there were about 600 kids that were arrested when they could have received a citation.
In the Fourth Circuit?
Yes. Well, that's in Duval County.
In Duval, pardon me. Okay, let's go to your calls right now as we speak with the Times Union's Tessa Duval. Have you been reading her series about juvenile diversion programs in Duval? It's 549-2937 to join us. Hank on the north side. Hi, Hank. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, my thoughts on the matter as far as the kids and diverting the kids so they won't, you know, go to try to not go to prison. We really have to look at the well-being of the parents. What's going on with the parents? There's a lot of single mothers that are struggling, other parents that are struggling. Anything we can do to help the parents, help the child's betterment, because a lot of times parents are doing things wrong and the kids see it and they wind up doing what the parents are doing as far as drugs concerned or any other thing that's not right, that's against the law. And I think those things need to be closely looked at, and we need to probably have some type of group to assess what's going on in these homes, to get these parents some help, some type of guidance to help these kids stay in school and, you know, not do the things that they are doing. Because a lot of them are, they just carrying guns and shooting everybody. So
okay.
That's not that thing.
Yeah.
Matter.
Thanks, Hank. Hank on the north side. Tessa?
I'm glad you that Hank actually brought up parents, because that is an important part of it. You know, with many of these programs, the family does have to play a role. I mean, they have to show up to neighborhood accountability boards. They have to go to parenting classes. They have to sometimes go on, for example, jail tours with the kids, juvenile drug court. They have to be there with the kid every other week. I mean, it is also a time commitment for the parents. And for the most part, parents are, you know, they might be irritated at their kid that, you know, oh, I've got to take off work, I've got to go do this with you. But they're also appreciative of the opportunity, because they know what it means if their kid doesn't have access to this program, and that means a record. And so they are thankful for that. That being said, there are some, like I said, that are frustrated, don't want to be there, don't want to take the time. And sometimes, you know, I observed all of the programs, and that was very apparent in the body language. You could see a parent slouched in their chair, didn't want to be there. And it was pretty easy to find the corresponding kid sometimes, because that kid had a similar attitude. So it really is something that starts in the home for sure.
549-2937, Dean in Jacksonville Beach. Hi, Dean. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Go ahead.
Hello. I'd like to know what a member of the general public could do to support these juvenile diversion programs. And let me be specific. If I have a retreat center that I would like to make available to an agency that would cycle these juveniles through for purposes of learning basic life skills and coping skills, who would I partner with? What agency may have a demand for such a facility?
Tessa.
All right, that's a good question. What I would encourage you to do is to reach out to court administration. They handle several of the programs in-house, and also maybe the state attorney's office to see if they have any interest. All of these diversion programs use community partners as much as they can. Mm. These really are community efforts that try to get a lot of different agencies and services made available to the kids. So, I mean, it certainly doesn't hurt to ask.
Lots of calls for the TU's Tessa Duvall. Her deep dive into juvenile diversion programs in Duval County. What are your questions about this? Chris in Jacksonville. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. I'm going to touch on a couple things real quick, and I'll take your response off on the air. I was in and out of the juvenile justice system quite a bit, ages 12 to 17. I'm well past that now, but I'm a product, somewhat a product of where I came from. I'm all for the juvenile diversion programs, and I think the first step of identifying what's motivating this type of behavior is going to be critical, and I wish I had been able to take a part in a program similar to that. But I did find a program when I was 17. Back then it was called the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act, but I was basically taught a skill, and from that point on basically became a productive member of society. But I'm very interested and supportive of the topic, and I'll be looking forward to hearing more about it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's go to Walter in downtown Jacksonville. Go ahead, Walter.
Hey, I participated in Clay County Teen Court when I was a teenager as a prosecuting attorney and also a little bit of defense. It was just a really positive experience, not only for the teenage attorneys involved, but also the kids. And a lot of times, the kids who had been through the process after having gotten arrested for something would later become teen court attorneys. So I just wanted to call in with that experience. Thanks.
Thanks. We're getting a lot of feedback from people who've had real-world experience with this. And how was that part of your reporting?
You know, so that was something that was fun, because I got to go to all of the programs. And as we just heard about teen court, that it's something it's really beneficial for a lot of the kids. And it's so interesting to watch the jurors, you know, because many of them have been sanctioned to serve on the jury, and to see them watching a defendant on the stand and trying to figure out, does this kid feel remorse? Do they realize what they did is wrong? You know, they really take it very seriously. And you know, it just I just think that the reflection that that helps them have, because maybe they didn't see why something was wrong when they were on the stand, but now that they see someone else in that situation having hurt someone or upset someone, they really don't like to see parents upset. They take all of these things into consideration when they're handing out sanctions.
549-2937, Dave in Nassau County. Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
Good morning. Happy Monday.
Yeah.
My comment is simply this. Perhaps this diversionary process is illustrative of the fact that our overall criminal justice system doesn't work, and that since we have focused strictly on punishment rather than some type of remunerative process, that our criminal justice system is not going to work, and that perhaps these types of diversionary programs could be a way for us to look at alternatives to simply locking people up, which we know full well doesn't work. And I'll take your response off the air. Thank you.
Dave in Nassau. Tessa Duvall.
I'm glad that was pointed out, because diversion programs are a highly effective way to keep kids from having future system involvement. Now, each program has a different recidivism rate. Some are more effective than others, although it's not always apples to apples comparisons, just because of the type of offenses and the depth of needs that some kids have. But for example, a civil citation program like Teen Court statewide has a recidivism rate of about 5% for the following year. It doubles if you arrest kids, then divert them. And it's even higher when you start talking about probation and putting kids in commitment programs. So really, this is a good way to catch kids before they get too deep in the system. And it's the best shot at preventing that future system involvement.
If the data then shows that these are effective and prevent recidivism, why aren't they more widely used? Is there still this sentiment that we've got to lock people up if they commit an offense? We've got to be tough, punitive.
Well, to hear the state attorney, Ms. Angela Corey, say it, she believes that she has a program that is more effective than civil citation. And by that, I mean her office uses what's called at-large diversion. In some cases, it still handles a lot of arrest cases, but this at-large diversion is, for example, the school district uses it for felonies or what might be felonies. But this is where the officer can just take a case file to the state attorney's office, and they decide how to proceed from there. And there's no arrest required in that either. It is more flexible because that allows felonies, but I was not able to kind of flesh out if her program is more effective for kids that receive at-large diversion or if they receive diversion after being arrested.
That's a question I think people want to know as well, don't they? I mean, why is it difficult to do that research?
You know,
just not enough data available?
You know, it's just tough because the state attorney's office keeps data differently than Teen Court, which keeps data differently than the way, mm-hmm. It's just when you have so many different agencies that are involved in these programs, I mean, really, it's just going to be difficult to ever get a very apples to oranges comparison.
Lots of comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Here are a few of them. We need more people to step up and be advocates and mentors for these kids. 2,000 of them is a lot in a city this size. We can do better. Here's another comment from a listener on Facebook. Last time I checked, in 2014, Duval County had 5 of the 10 youngest people on death row, barely 18 and already committing violent crimes. The school-to-prison pipeline sometimes ends not just in prison, but on death row. Diversion today means less violent crime tomorrow. Let's go now to Paul in Orange Park. Hi, Paul. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yes, I'd like to point out what a conviction early in a person's life can have on their ability to get work, ability to get a gun permit. I was convicted of 3 nonviolent misdemeanors when I was young, and 43 years later, I can't even get a gun permit. So I'm gonna have to go back and have that record expunged at some cost. And I think that, if they had addressed my situation in something like the court that you're talking about, which didn't exist then, my life would have had a much better path. I would have had a bunch better jobs. I'd be much better off financially. And I'm very strongly in favor of alternative methods of helping the young people who get into trouble to see, you know, the error of their way, to see the long-range consequences, and to be persuaded to abide by the laws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Paul. Thanks for that. And let's go now to Ira on the South Side. Go ahead, Ira. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Thank you. Terrific. Very important show. I'm the proud father of two Eagle Scouts. Has your guest, who seems to have done some great research, has she found out whether or not there's a diversion possibility into Girl Scout, Boy Scout troops and explorers as a form of taking these children through a life training diversion as opposed to what they're doing now? Can we not ask Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts of Northeast Florida to step up? I noticed the picture in the paper last week of the 250 new Eagle Scouts in Duval County. There was probably three kids of color in that group. Can we not ask them to step up? Thank you.
Okay, Ira. Interesting questions today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that one thing that, for example, Teen Court emphasizes is the role of positive peer pressure. When we hear peer pressure, we often think that it's very negative. You know, it's, hey, shoplift this. It's, hey, you know, smoke this, do that. But when Teen Court uses peer pressure, it is a jury of your peers.
Very powerful.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's saying that was wrong for you to do that. It's not, you know, not beating them down or making them feel bad, but hearing from people your own age that, hey, that's not cool. You know, do you see how upset your mom looks? Do you really want to do that? So I think that groups that encourage positive peer interaction definitely have a role in keeping kids out of trouble.
And in the meantime, you will have more reporting on this tomorrow.
Yes. So part two of this brief series comes tomorrow. This is where we really look at the effectiveness. We look at the methodology because there are some approaches to diversion that are more effective than others. And we find out how exactly we do those here in Duval County. And we also learn more about the juvenile drug court and the state attorney's youthful offender program. So I'm really looking forward to day two.
Read it tomorrow. She's Tessa Duval, education, children, and families reporter with the Florida Times Union. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
And much more still ahead later. Culpepper on the Final Four. But up next, First Coast Success profiles Deutsche Bank chief Leslie Slover. Back in a moment.
WJCT is a source of pride in our community because friends just like you value our service and contribute to it. If you haven't donated, it's time to give. Donate any amount that works for your budget. Give online at WJCT.org or call us at 904-353-9528. The drive ends when we reach our goal. Thanks.
On the next Fresh Air, we hear about a brigade of volunteers who fought in the Spanish Civil War and the surprising story of an American oil executive who secretly aided Spain's dictator Francisco Franco during the conflict. We talk with Adam Hochschild, author of Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936-39. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Join WJCT for a special sneak preview of Ken Burns' Jackie Robinson documentary, Sunday, April 3rd, in the Virginia Room in the Ringhaver Student Center of Flagler College. The film depicts the life and accomplishments of baseball legend and civil rights pioneer Jack Roosevelt Robinson, who fearlessly crossed baseball's color line and continued fighting discrimination after his baseball career ended. Reception begins at 3 with screening and discussion to follow. This event is free, but registration is required. Info at wjct.org/events.
Welcome back. Well, she's the CEO of a growing banking concern in our area. In today's edition of First Coast Success, Karen Bruni Mathis of the Financial News and Daily Record speaks with Leslie Slover, regional head of Deutsche Bank.
Mm-hmm. Leslie Slover leads a global company's very big presence in Jacksonville. Slover is the regional head of Deutsche Bank in Jacksonville and Cary, North Carolina. The Jacksonville office opened in 2008 and has grown to almost 2,000 employees on the South Side. She joined Germany-based Deutsche Bank in 1997 and moved to Jacksonville in 2014. Along with leading the company's Jacksonville expansion, she also sits on boards, including at the Jax Chamber and the Board of Trustees for the Jacksonville Museum of Contemporary Art. Leslie Slover, welcome to First Coast Success.
Karen, thank you so much for having me here this morning.
Now, Deutsche Bank is not a retail bank in Jacksonville. What does the bank do here? Briefly go over a few of the many functions.
Sure. And that's true, Karen. We are not a retail bank here in the U.S. We do not have ATMs. Deutsche Bank is a leading global bank. Jacksonville has evolved from a single-function operations center to a multi-divisional regional office. Jacksonville has most of the operating businesses and infrastructure functions are here. The divisions represented are global markets, which is our sales and trading business, our corporate and investment banking, global transaction banking, information technology, finance, cybersecurity, compliance, legal, group audit, and anti-financial crime. Obviously, we have a lot going on.
You do, and there's more every day from what we can tell. Now, your business, banking and finance, and especially at Deutsche Bank, it's very incredibly fast-paced. Mm-hmm. You obviously enjoy that. What motivates you?
The pace of the market and the industry really motivates me. I fell in love with the trading floor from a very early point in my career. I had done profit and loss calculations for a trading desk. And although there was email at the time, you had to physically take the profit and loss statement over to the trading floor for the trader to sign off. And the minute, as I kind of got my confidence up and started to go to the trading floor more, I just knew I loved it. I was hooked. I love the fact that every day was going to be different, that it constantly keeps you on your toes, and that you constantly have to react to outside influences.
Well, you volunteer and you encourage your employees to do the same. What are some of the organization and events that the bank supports?
Giving back to the communities in which we operate is very much part of our DNA. We find it incredibly important for our employees to get involved, and we have been very successful in our efforts down here in Jacksonville. We really do focus on the arts, education, and community, as well as finding partners to think about acting sustainably. So some of our local organizations that we've partnered with have been Generation W, the Girl Scouts, Feeding Northeast Florida, Mocha of Jacksonville. The list goes on and on.
Well, as a leader of almost 2,000 employees and heading over that, which is a big business, how would you describe your leadership skills?
In my career, I've been very focused on leading by example. As I've been with the bank for nearly 20 years and have come up the ranks, I've had the opportunity to do a lot of the jobs that I actually am responsible to supervise today. I've always been interested in rolling up my sleeves, willing to get my hands dirty, just like everyone else on the team. This has enabled me to get involved in a variety of projects and keeping me constantly challenged and invigorated. It's this work ethic and I think sort of the team mentality that has really enabled me to get recognized by my peers and as a leader.
What are the challenges in your business?
Well, the banking industry right now does not have a lack of challenges. Over the past few years, obviously, we've had the emergence from the financial crisis. We've been managing the regulatory landscape changes, which are many, and truly rebuilding trust with society. So the challenges are many.
And how do you respond to those?
I've always welcomed challenge, which in turn has helped shape my career. You know, I mentioned sort of getting involved in special projects. My experience at Drexel Burnham Lambert very early on. I had only been with the bank 3 or 4 years when it went bankrupt, so that was a big experience for me. Y2K, the implementation from a technology perspective. And I've helped Deutsche Bank as well during critical times. We've gone through quite a bit of change post the crisis. I was the COO responsible for the business footprint during that time. And although challenges can be stressful, they usually result in positive change, and it's exciting to be part of such a process.
What is your advice to those who want to provide effective leadership? Do you have any career tips?
As my career has progressed, and I think most recently what I've realized is the importance for open dialogue. I think it's critical for every level, and I credit Deutsche Bank's culture of teamwork for instilling open dialogue across regions, businesses, and teams. In Jacksonville, I've instituted an open door policy between staff and management, have regular meetings with staff at multiple levels to get feedback. And with this open dialogue, I think we have improved the sense of community at DB Jacksonville and connectivity globally with our peers.
You work a lot with the city as well. What advice or suggestions do you have for city leaders as they continue to recruit national and international companies?
Through my work with the board chamber, I've had the opportunity to meet with some of those new firms who are considering Jacksonville. And we've talked a lot about that, that building the foundation for a footprint in a new location takes time, requires patience, but it's certainly well worth it. And DB, as I've said, is very pleased with the operation here.
Yeah, there have been a lot of national and international global companies that have moved to Jacksonville in the past year or two.
I guess sort of just to the flip side of my last comment, I would tell those international and national companies how welcoming the community of Jacksonville has been, how accessible everyone has been. The city is run by an incredible group of people who really go out of their way to make sure that you're connecting with others. And to have found a home here, I think Deutsche Bank has been very, very lucky.
Leslie Slover, Regional Head of Deutsche Bank in Jacksonville and in Cary, North Carolina. Thanks for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you, Karen.
And check out a partial transcript of Karen's talk with Leslie Slover of Deutsche Bank in today's Daily Record. Back in a moment.
Today's First Coast Success was brought to you in part by Iberia Bank.
Artists, would you like your photography, music, paintings, or poetry featured on WJCT? Submit your work to The Square, an online gallery and competition for local artists. Winners get a quality video produced by WJCT about their work. If you've submitted during a past round, you can submit again. Share your work now at wjct.org/thesquare. Presented by WJCT and Grassroots Natural Market.
Relax Radio is coming to 89.9 FM, April 1st. Tune in to the music of your life only on 89.9 FM, WJCT. Your community, your world.
My sweet Lady J, when I see you again, your servant am I, and will humbly remain.
Next time on I've Always Wondered.
So some people coupon for everything and they have like 400 hot sauces, and that's not how I like to operate because I know when there's a limit, I guess you could say.
I'm Molly Wood. Who really benefits from coupons? Next time on Marketplace from APM.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next reveal, Lena's son made a business out of shuttling Latinos to work illegally in Chinese restaurants all over the country.
Listen, you have to use your head with those Mexicans, understand? You have to scare them a little. Then you won't have a problem.
But she had a problem when authorities tapped her phones.
We're busted. He's going to get the immigration office involved.
On the next reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, Jacksonville's big TEDx event is getting a new venue this year. It's the Florida Theater. That will double the audience for the conference, and the theme has just been released for 2016, too. It's Fearless. TEDx Executive Director Sabine Perwes is here to tell us all about it. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good to see you. It's great to have you. And for several years now, the TEDx Jacksonville event has been here in our own WJCT studios. This year, you're moving to the Florida Theater. That will enable you to have a much bigger audience. Pretty exciting.
It's really exciting and slightly frightening. We are sad to be leaving WJCT. We've been here for 3 years, and you know the audience was always cramming for more seats. So we have listened, and we're expanding to 700 in hopes of meeting that demand.
You're also adding some new engagement to this event. The 2016 conference will be in the fall at the Florida Theater.
Correct.
How, in addition to the extra seats, how else can people be part of this?
So one new component we're adding this year is called TEDx Adventures. We are going to be really giving a behind-the-scene access to our partner organizations, local businesses, and community organizations by really giving our audience members a sneak peek into what else takes place in these organizations, and they will have the opportunity to sign up at October's event.
Let's explain what TED is all about, the global TED Talks. The TED acronym is, I think it's Technology, Entertainment, and Design.
Correct.
But the talks that speakers give go way beyond those three buckets.
You could really, if you are bored at any point of your day, you can really go on TED.com and put in whatever topic of interest, and you will get a boatload of talks that are, you know, 5 minutes or under or 15 minutes. But the idea really is to give audience members or viewers a sneak peek into a thought process or an idea word spreading, and then hoping that they will be so inspired by this idea that they will go ahead and discover it further on their own time.
And some of the TED Talks that are available online have received hundreds of millions of views. What are some of the all-star TED Talks that have really made an impact around the world, would you say?
I think one that comes to mind is Simon Sinek, really the thoughts around leadership and how great leaders should lead. You know, there's been great talks in education. You guys mentioned the Southern Law Poverty Center, Brian Stevenson, and his work. He was able to gather $1 million at the conference just by his demonstration. And, you know, Tessa is a great example. She spoke last year, and she actually just got back from Kentucky and spoke at their Idea Festival along the same topic. So it really gives a new perspective to the issues in our community and really empowers individuals that you don't have to be highly qualified or skilled in any one specific thing. You can be a grassroots leader and really lead change.
And the theme this year is Fearless. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that.
We really wanted to inspire individuals to not feel like I am not the best person to do whatever it is that they're trying to change. We wanted them to look beyond, you know, if fear did not exist, what would you like to do? So we decided to go with Fearless in hopes of getting people to think of, if I didn't have fear, I would do more of, and whatever that blank is, that is what we're really seeking from our potential speakers and performers this year, because our application process is open. So anyone is encouraged to apply, and we're hoping to get lots of Fearless speakers.
And TEDxJacksonville.com is the place to go. The deadline's coming up later this year in the summer. In the meantime, you have some salons scheduled.
So salons are small community discussions where we pick one topic of interest for the community, and then we have local panelists and a moderator really go into the topic and then have a Q&A. So our first one coming up is April 16th, Aging, Everybody's Doing It. And we're really looking at the ramifications of just longer lives. You know, our society is living longer. What does that mean for us when it comes to our society, philanthropy, biology, as well as just impact? So, you know, financial decisions that usually just come up when people are at the end of life, but how can we plan for that early on?
And as we mentioned earlier, because of sellout capacity crowds at the TEDx events here at WJCT each year, you are expanding to this bigger venue at Florida Theater this fall. I think that speaks to the popularity of this event here on the First Coast.
Yes, we're really excited to be going into our fifth year and are so thankful for the support that we've received. I mean, the team of volunteers definitely appreciates it, and it's nice to know that the work is rewarded.
And so if you're just tuning in, as we speak with TEDx executive producer Sabine Pairways, the TEDx event will be in October this year in Jacksonville at the Florida Theater, no longer at WJCT. We're happy to have played a big role, though, in launching this in our area. And of course, the X at the end of TED means it's sort of a satellite event, right?
Correct. The X stands for independently organized. So TED gives us licenses to hold these events, but we are, given some rules to follow. But aside from that, we curate it ourselves. We staff it ourselves. It's a team of 25 volunteers who all have other full-time jobs, but they really do this because they care about the First Coast and they want to help make it a better place to live.
Which, can I ask this, which local TED Talk has had the most views so far?
Oh, John Phillips.
John Phillips, yes, the lawyer.
Yes, he is well over 150,000 views and has really resonated with the community both nationally and locally.
And his talk was about?
His talk was about Jordan Davis and that case and just John's upbringing in Birmingham, Alabama, and how that kind of curated his life throughout.
And so that gives you a sense of the type of impact TEDx Jacksonville has made over the last 5 years here on the First Coast. The theme this fall is fearless. If you want to apply to give a talk at the fall event, just go to TEDxJacksonville.com and check out the website and mark your calendar for their salon, a smaller discussion coming up next month. Executive producer Sabine Pairways helming this wonderful initiative here in our area. It's always good to see you, and thank you so much for bringing us up today. We look forward to it.
Thank you, Melissa.
Back in a moment with Cole Pepper as the final four is set. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Kilbride. We want to reach our $80,000 fundraising goal without interrupting programs, and we know from listener feedback that you would like that too. You have the power to shorten or even eliminate our traditional pledge drive by giving now at WJCT.org. Support the programs you love and spare the interruptions by making your pledge today at 904-353-9528. Thanks.
I'm Al Letson, and I'm hosting a brand new show here on WJCT, and I'm bringing some friends with me.
Everything, with Al Letson as the host and Willie Evans Jr. as the DJ. Well, he's not really a DJ, but he does something.
Every week, we'll be bringing you some stories, some laughs, and something to think about. Sundays at 2 and Wednesdays at 1. Everything. It's a new show, because we're going to do everything we want.
Everything. The opposite of nothing.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Amy Robach, news anchor of ABC's Good Morning America, will be this year's afternoon keynote speaker at Girls' Day Out, September 17, 2016, Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Amy is also a breast cancer awareness advocate and author of My Breast Cancer Journey, From Fighter to Thriver. For more information or for tickets, log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, the Final Four is set in college basketball.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
From college hoops to who just might be the Jaguars' first round draft pick, Cole Pepper, here now to tell us all about it. And so the first question I must ask is, did you pick the Final Four in your brackets?
Not even close.
Okay.
I did have North Carolina.
So there's one.
Okay.
But and I did have Oklahoma. So two out of four.
That's
but,
not bad.
Well, it's not great, but it's, you know, I guess if you were to think, hey, there were 68 teams, randomly pick four of them and you get half of those right, you feel pretty good.
Yeah, not exactly better than I would have done.
It's not exactly random, although sometimes it feels that way. In a year that in college basketball saw six different teams over the course of basically 19 weeks hold the number one spot, maybe it's no surprise that the top seeds didn't get all the way through, but only that one, North Carolina, of the number one seeds made it to the Final Four in Houston for this week's matchup. So we've got a second seed Villanova taking on a second seed Oklahoma, and a 10 seed Syracuse that a lot of people wondered if they really deserved to be in the tournament. I guess this answers that question. We'll take on North Carolina. Clearly, the Tar Heels are the prohibitive favorite at this point to give Roy Williams his third national championship. I do think that the matchup is going to wind up being, and we'll find out next week at this time when they play the championship on Monday night. I think it's going to wind up being Oklahoma against North Carolina. You'll have the probably the most talented team across the board taking on maybe the best player in the country in Buddy Hield of Oklahoma.
You know what, though? It's like you were saying the last time we talked about this. It's always exciting to see a team in a school that's really seen as an underdog get really far along. You can't help but root for them.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Villanova, Oklahoma, and North Carolina were three of those six teams that were ranked number one at one point this year. Syracuse is not exactly what you would say as a, you know, an underdog program. They, you know, they've been one of the top programs over the last 20 years, but this year, kind of an underdog team. It's hard to really call them a Cinderella story, but there'll be a lot of people who will be rooting for the quote-unquote underdog, I think, with Syracuse.
Okay, let's talk about the Jaguars. Cole says they're about a month out from making their first-round draft pick, and you have some thoughts as to who it might be.
Yeah, in fact, exactly a month from today, the draft begins, and the Jaguars most likely to go defense. Pass rush would be the top priority. They could go linebacker, cornerback, or safety as well. But I think one of the keys for the Jaguars is to watch what the four teams ahead of them do between now and the draft. The Titans are trying to trade the top overall pick. They don't need a quarterback. Usually quarterbacks are the top pick. Not always, but usually. They drafted Marcus Mariota last year. So Laremy Tunsil, the tackle from Ole Miss, is considered to be the most likely number one overall pick. The Titans could certainly use him unless they can get something better out of a trade. Mm-hmm. The Browns need a quarterback. But they just signed Robert Griffin III, so will they use a first-round pick on a quarterback? The Chargers don't need a quarterback, and the Cowboys maybe could use a quarterback. So the big key for the Jaguars is, because they don't need a quarterback clearly, that if you get two quarterbacks drafted ahead of them, that means that, assuming that those quarterbacks aren't truly two of the top five players in the draft, that the Jaguars should get a top three talent with that fifth pick in the draft, which could be a big plus. And I think the Jaguars' choice is going to come down to these players. Florida State defensive back Jalen Ramsey, who's an unbelievable athlete, has a Michael Jordan-esque vertical leap and can play cornerback or safety. Miles Jack, equally athletic linebacker from UCLA, and Ohio State defensive end Joey Bosa. Outside shot of Oregon defensive lineman DeForest Buckner and Shaq Lawson, the defensive end from Clemson. Right now, if I were forced to pick, I'd say it's going to be Miles Jack, the UCLA linebacker, but it remains to be seen. A lot can happen in the month leading up to the draft.
And let's say it is Miles Jack. Can he take this team where they really want to go?
Well, you know, no one player can say, maybe with the possible exception of a quarterback, can say he's going to take them. But he would be part of an offseason that would see the Jaguars address a lot of key spots. And I think the Jaguars would like to have an upgrade in that other outside linebacker position where he would play. And it would give them a lot of speed on defense. And coupled with the other free agent moves they've made, I think it would be a real positive. The Jaguars already getting considered, you know, top three or four free agency periods in the NFL.
Let's talk about the Armada. 13 days out from the start of their second season, you've been with them as calling the games and being the voice of the team for the first season, and it's been a really successful launch.
Yeah, it certainly has in terms of building the fan community and the supporters. And from a team standpoint, I think they're going to be a much deeper team this year, so much so that they felt comfortable in selling off one of their bright young players, Jamaican forward Akil Barrett, who scored three goals last year. He's off to Sweden now. He was one of the fastest players in the NASL. So the Armada kick off their season April 10th. They go on the road to take on the defending champion New York Cosmos. And this Saturday, they're holding a season kickoff party calling the Anchors Away Party.
Nice.
Out at a suite at the Town Center where we'll introduce the team, an autograph session, and generally get everybody fired up for the season with new head coach Tony Meola.
And more soccer news in terms of the World Cup qualifier. What's going on there?
The U.S. men's national team, a poor result, losing to Guatemala for the first time since 1988. There is some pressure now on U.S. head coach Jurgen Klinsmann. The U.S. does stand the risk of failing to make it to the next round of the World Cup qualifying, which would be just an absolute disaster for U.S. soccer.
Last but not least, in addition to calling the Armada games, you, Cole Pepper, are now the brand new Jaguars expert at About.com. Very exciting.
Thank you. Yeah, it gives me another platform to write about the Jaguars, so that's always good. And listen, obviously I needed something else to do with my spare time. And tomorrow night I'll be doing the public address announcing for the Florida State baseball game down at the stadium.
Oh, very nice. Yes.
So, yeah, you know, obviously I had 20 or 30 extra minutes a week I needed to fill up.
He's everywhere. Follow him on Twitter, at Cole Pepper, for all your sports news and notes. And check him out at about.com. Always good to see you. Congrats.
Thank you very much.
All right, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchuk. Make sure to catch our video on demand segments every day now at tvjax.com. And next on Diane Rehm, thousands of voters waited hours to cast ballots in primaries out west. This year, 16 states will have new voting restrictions for the first time in a presidential election. A look at access to voting across the U.S. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.